morning and welcome to The Bridge. I'm Kate Brister. This morning, we bring the Paris Climate Talks home to the West Coast and look at the plans of five mayors who aren't waiting for the UN or Congress to make changes. The mayors have formed a partnership to work on the issues of climate change and homelessness. Now, these are mayors of large metropolitan cities, Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, but small towns aren't immune. Journalist Nancy McCarthy is the former editor of the Cannon Beach Gazette and the Seaside Signal, and a staff writer for the Daily Historian. Today, she joins Coast Community Radio to talk about the challenges of housing on the North Coast.
Housing studies done in Astoria and Cannon Beach in Clatsop County show that a large portion of residents in those two towns can't afford to rent or buy housing in the areas where they work. In Astoria, one landlord characterized the housing shortage as dire.
In the second half, Austin Jenkins examines one of the biggest roadblocks to fundamental change, the revolving door between state regulators and executives in the energy industry. The big climate agreement in Paris last weekend is expected to have a variety of effects in Oregon and along the West Coast, although it may take a while to see them. That's the view of Michael Brune. He heads the Sierra Club. He was in Paris for the talks between representatives of 195 nations. The plan is supposed to keep the global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius or about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Brune says for now, the West is stuck with a combination of wild weather, drought, fires, and coastal sea level rise.
What we also know is that this agreement will begin to slow that down. It will begin to minimize the risk of it getting unsustainably worse, but it will not solve the problem.
Scientific reviews of the agreement say it reduces greenhouse gas emissions by only about half what is needed to keep global temperatures in check. Brune calls it promising, an even historic start. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley also was in Paris and said partnering with other nations will help accelerate research and keep driving down the cost of clean energy. There's been some criticism of the agreement for providing financial help to countries that until now haven't done much to help themselves reduce pollution. No specific dollar amounts were set, but Brune says it's an acknowledgement that every nation has a role to play. And for U.S. businesses, helping to level the playing field could provide new opportunities.
Every country in the world shares the same fate, and now every country in the world is sharing part of the burden. But what we're also seeing is an increased level of ambition in which countries are committing to do more collectively than they ever have.
Brune says U.S. participation in the UN climate agreement doesn't require congressional approval, although Congress or states could make it more difficult for the country to meet emissions targets by defunding some efforts or through court challenges. Mayors from five West Coast cities have announced a new alliance. The leaders of Portland, Seattle, Eugene, San Francisco, and Los Angeles say they will collaborate on issues including climate change and reducing homelessness. San Francisco's mayor announced this week that the city's fleet of trucks now runs on renewable diesel fuel. The fuel for San Francisco's fire engines and dump trucks comes from a refinery in Singapore. It's made from a type of palm oil and from waste animal fat and discarded fish parts. Mayor Ed Lee says the city doesn't have to retrofit its trucks because the fuel is essentially identical to conventional diesel. He said that represents a reduction of 50,000 metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions, a huge contribution to the environment and to cleaner air. The mayor's also pledged to fund new research to identify the causes of homelessness in the West and to study the demographics of the homeless population. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti said gathering new data will clarify how issues like failures in the foster care system or the current heroin epidemic contribute to homelessness. The mayors say they also plan to gather data to understand what programs are effective at moving people out of homelessness. They say the research funded by the West Coast Mayors Alliance will be available to the public. Thank you. typically think of the homeless as unemployed. Here on the North Coast, it takes more than full employment, even in a well-paid position, to manage a home or even find a place to rent. This morning, The Bridge welcomes a new voice to the Coast Community Radio family. Nancy McCarthy is familiar to readers of the Daily A, the Cannon Beach Gazette, and the Seaside Signal. Today, Nancy examines the issue of affordable housing on the North Oregon coast. Clatsop County ranks among the top five counties in Oregon with the greatest number of homeless citizens. It's a complex problem with few immediate solutions in sight.
With its sparkling beaches and quaint towns, the North Oregon coast may be a great place to visit, but not everyone can live in paradise. Housing studies done in Astoria and Cannon Beach in Clatsop County show that a large portion of residents in those two towns can't afford to rent or buy housing in the areas where they work. No more than 30% of a household's annual income should go to housing costs, according to generally accepted guidelines. But a lack of low-cost apartments and houses, along with reduced incomes, force people to pay more for housing if they can find it. In Astoria, one landlord characterized the housing shortage as dire. Nearly one-third of homeowners and nearly half of the city's renters pay more than 30% of their income to stay in their homes. That means they may have trouble meeting other necessities, including food, transportation, and medical care. The annual median household income in Astoria is $42,000. About three-quarters of Astoria households should be considered low-income, according to the housing study. The median monthly rate in Astoria is $700, and the median monthly mortgage is $1,500. To stay within the guideline limits, a family of four in Astoria could afford a house costing no more than $250,000. Although the average sales price for a single-family home in Astoria is $230,000, there are few such homes available, and those that are available often need major repairs, according to the study. While government assistance is offered, low-income residents must wait 3 years to get that assistance. Last May, names stopped being added to the list until the wait is reduced to 2 years. Special needs groups, including minorities, veterans, the elderly, and those with physical and mental disabilities, face even more challenges when navigating the housing market. Adding to the housing demand is the influx of U.S. Coast Guard families who are stationed in Astoria. Although the Coast Guard offers housing, there remains a shortage. That means that Coast Guard families compete with others for limited housing throughout the area, which drives up costs. The Astoria housing study suggests possible solutions. The city could allow more smaller dwellings near existing houses, and city officials should work more closely with agencies that provide subsidized housing. The housing study also suggests that a survey should be done to find vacant land to build more housing. Existing housing could be improved to provide more affordable rents, according to the study's recommendations. 25 miles south of Astoria is Cannon Beach. While this village of 1,600 has a reputation as a resort town with high-end hotels, 70% of the residents pay too much in housing costs. Those who work in the local hotels, restaurants, and shops can't afford to live in town. Instead, they commute from Seaside or Warrenton, where housing is cheaper. A city task force is investigating how affordable housing can be developed. But there is little vacant land in the town squeezed between the ocean and the mountains. Houses sell for an average of $600,000, four times the average in Oregon. While the median household income in Cannon Beach is $53,000, housing costs are out of reach for most residents, and they aren't eligible for government assistance. There also are few long-term rentals available. Instead, owners of second homes realize they can rent their houses out to tourists on a short-term basis for much more than they could get from a long-term tenant. At least 148 houses in Cannon Beach are listed on the VRBO Vacation Home website, with an average rental of $263 a night. Even more vacation rental homes are offered by local property management companies. The Cannon Beach City Council changed its zoning ordinance 20 years ago to allow accessory buildings on properties. The council hoped these additional 600-square-foot residences would act as workforce housing, but most are being used as overnight rentals. Two low-income housing developments, Shorewood and Elk Creek Terrace, are available. But the waiting lists for both developments are a year long, and they have strict income limits. With the lack of affordable housing for low- and medium-income residents, the homeless population in Clatsop County continues to grow. Clatsop ranks among the top five counties in Oregon with the most number of homeless. Alan Evans, executive director of the Helping Hands Emergency Shelter in Seaside, says the shelter has helped 700 men, women, and children so far this year. And the winter, the toughest season for the homeless, has only just begun. I'm Nancy McCarthy, reporting for Coast Community Radio.
You're listening to The Bridge. We've been looking at the challenges of climate change and homelessness this morning. We've heard about the commitments of Western mayors and local city governments to meet these challenges. Now Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins takes an in-depth look at the response to climate change in his state. Washington Governor Jay Inslee has set his sights on a clean energy future. Since taking office, he's helped convince the legislature to put $75 million into a clean energy fund. Will the money go to projects for which it was intended? In a two-part report, we'll take a look at the many government insiders that have gone to work for big energy companies that are now benefiting from some of that clean energy money.
This is something you don't often hear from the head of a state agency.
I would say in hindsight, I wish I would have asked more questions.
That's Brian Bondlender, director of Washington's Department of Commerce. He's reflecting on the fact that three former commerce officials now work for private subcontractors on state-funded clean energy projects. This has given ammunition to critics of the governor, like Republican State Senator Doug Erickson.
And that's the type of thing where the people of Washington State look at and say, that's just too cozy of a relationship to be occurring in Washington.
So what actually happened? Last year, Commerce awarded more than $14 million in matching grants to three utilities. The purpose of the grants was to help the utilities experiment with battery storage. Batteries are a way to harness wind and solar power. They can also be used to store energy from the grid during non-peak times. The grants were awarded through a competitive process designed and scored by an outside panel. After the grants were awarded, the utilities subcontracted out much of the work. Two of those subcontracts went to a Seattle startup called One Energy Systems. One Energy makes software that tells batteries when to charge and when to discharge. That's where two former Commerce officials come in.
My name is Rogers Weed. I run product management for One Energy Systems.
Previously, Weed was director of the Washington Department of Commerce under former Governor Chris Gregoire.
So my name is Daniel Malarkey, and I lead the business development and public policy efforts here at One Energy Systems.
Malarkey was Weed's deputy at Commerce. Both men are named in anonymous ethics complaints that allege violations of the state's law regulating employment after public service. The complaints were filed with the Washington State Executive Ethics Board and named several current and former Commerce officials. Weed thinks they're politically motivated and says the order of events is important.
My chronology is I was gone from state service before the Clean Energy Fund was even proposed, much less contracts evaluated and awarded.
Weed's deputy, Malarkey, stayed on under Governor Inslee and helped write a policy memo that formed the basis for Inslee's Clean Energy Fund. Malarkey says One Energy approached him about a job in June of 2013. One of his duties would be helping One Energy's utility customers apply for state clean energy grants. Malarkey says he consulted the state ethics law and sought legal advice.
And the conclusion that I reached then and still hold is that my activities at One Energy are completely compliant.
Malarkey says before he left Commerce, he took no action to benefit One Energy. Once he started at the company, Malarkey says he did help with the clean energy grant applications, but currently has no role with the grant-funded projects. A third former Commerce staffer, lawyer Michael Carr, went to work for a different subcontractor, battery maker UniEnergy. At Commerce, Carr helped negotiate the clean energy contracts between the state and the utilities.
I was in the room, yeah, but it wasn't my decision. I was sitting next to Richard.
Richard is Richard Locke, who oversaw the Clean Energy Fund at the Department of Commerce.
He was more than just the attorney.
A letter sent to the winners of the grant competition said Carr would lead negotiations. Locke says he found out Carr was leaving to work at UniEnergy the day the last contract was signed. That's the day Governor Inslee announced the grant winners at an event at UniEnergy.
I was told as I was leaving the event that Mike's taking a job here. I was shocked. I frankly didn't believe it.
Carr insists that Locke is wrong and says he wasn't even approached about the new job until later.
After the announcements were made.
Carr says he too consulted ethics advisors at Commerce about taking a job with a subcontractor. The answer back was that it was okay, but that Carr would be wise to wall himself off from working on the clean energy grant projects. Carr says that firewall is in place at UniEnergy, and his focus is on business development.
I'm helping us build markets elsewhere.
Carr is also one of the eight people named in the series of anonymous ethics complaints. All three former Commerce staffers are adamant they didn't violate state ethics rules, and it all may have been perfectly legal. But Richard Locke worries this revolving door gives the appearance of conflict of interest. And that concerns him because he's a huge supporter of the state promoting clean energy.
I think it damages a mission to have this sort of perception of misuse and favoritism.
When questions were raised, current Commerce Director Brian Bondlender did make some changes at his agency. He required additional ethics training and added new conflict of interest rules for contractors. He also asked the State Ethics Board for an opinion on whether any rules were violated, but that request was trumped by the anonymous ethics complaints. The board could decide in January whether to dismiss or pursue those complaints.
We continue our look at the question of clean energy money and where it might be going with Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins. We find out that some Washington State energy grant money is flowing to startup companies staffed by former state officials. That overlap has fueled a larger debate about the value of spending state dollars on emerging technologies.
In Mukilteo, Washington, there's a company called UniEnergy Technologies. It makes batteries. Giant batteries that can store up energy from the electric grid.
Here, come see this.
Russ Weed is the energetic vice president for business development at UniEnergy. He says energy storage is
the holy grail of the power industry, and it has been sought for decades.
Weed guides visitors to the back loading dock at company headquarters. Out here, shipping containers like the ones you see at the port are stacked up. But it's what goes inside these containers that Weed says represents a major technological breakthrough, a vanadium flow battery that can be shipped anywhere in the world.
Well, you weren't able to containerize a vanadium flow battery before because it was too big.
Vanadium flow technology holds appeal because, unlike lithium, it retains its ability to hold a charge. UniEnergy is a young company with about 40 employees and the backing of Chinese investors. But it's also indirectly getting some early stage funds from Washington taxpayers. That's because UniEnergy has contracts to provide battery technology to two Washington utilities that are recipients of state clean energy grants. Weed says that public investment is very important for companies like his to grow.
Chicken and egg problem. How do you get installations without happy customer references? But how do you get happy customer references without installations?
The state's matching grant program gives startups like UniEnergy and Seattle software company OneEnergy the ability to demonstrate their products in a real-world environment. David Kaplan is the CEO and founder of OneEnergy.
And you can see the power is now flowing onto the grid.
Kaplan is demonstrating OneEnergy's software that tells batteries when to charge and discharge. He says the state grant money that makes its way to his company also helps electric utilities innovate.
Many, many benefits come to the state of Washington as a result of the work that we're doing in partnership with others.
Kaplan was among a small group of clean tech insiders invited to a meeting with Governor Inslee in 2013 as the Clean Energy Fund was being developed. He was also a consultant to the Washington Department of Commerce, the agency that now manages the grant program. The idea that state money is flowing to clean energy startups troubles Republican State Senator Doug Erickson. He chairs the Senate Energy Committee.
To pick and choose winners and losers in this type of technology environment with taxpayer dollars is a very difficult thing to do.
Erickson says the state should stick to investing in research and development, but a spokesman for Inslee disagrees. David Postman defends the decision to target state dollars to modernizing the electric grid.
We need new technology here that's going to push this. And the governor has this particular interest in this because, like with electric cars, it's all about the battery.
Complicating the debate is the fact that both OneEnergy and UniEnergy have put former high-level Washington Department of Commerce staffers on the payroll. Commerce runs the grant program. That's given ammunition to critics like Erickson.
And you end up with situations like this where high-ranking executives in the executive branch from Department of Commerce that oversees these types of grants end up being the beneficiaries of the companies that receive those funds.
The individuals involved say they've complied with all ethics rules regarding employment after state service. Last spring, Erickson called Commerce officials before his committee to explain their handling of the Clean Energy Grant Program. Again, Inslee spokesman David Postman.
There were some questions. We answered those questions in an open hearing. The Department of Commerce did. And then they put some provisions in there to do better the next time.
Earlier this year, the Washington legislature reauthorized Inslee's Clean Energy Fund, but with new safeguards. That fund includes the matching grant program. For instance, grant applicants must now reveal if a former state employee is on the payroll. Richard Locke is the former head of the Energy Office at the Department of Commerce and a supporter of Inslee's clean energy policies. But he says he'd like to see even stronger rules to stop the revolving door.
Once you go to work for the state, once you're involved in allocating these resources, you can't go to work for the recipient of these grants for a period of years.
Washington law already requires a cooling-off period for former state employees before they go to work directly on a contract they helped authorize. Some argue a broader prohibition would dissuade people in the private sector from wanting to come to work in state government in the first place. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Our thanks to Austin Jenkins for his report. Austin was aided by Jim Bruner of the Seattle Times. Our thanks also to Nancy McCarthy. Nancy has joined the team as a regular contributor to the news department and The Bridge. Welcome, Nancy. We look forward to hearing again from you soon. And we enjoy hearing from you. Email questions or comments to News One, that's NEWS and the numeral one, and you can like us on Facebook. This program is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thanks for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge.